Friends, if I could invite you to stretch out and collect a Bible. We're going to be reading this morning from Daniel chapter 5 together. Daniel 5, it's page 889 in the Pew Bibles. We're going through our biggest story here in Hill Street. We reached Daniel last week, and we're spending 3 weeks looking at this wonderful book, but difficult book in the Old Testament. Last week, we read about King Nebuchadnezzar and his interactions with Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar, we know, was this great Babylonian king who ruled whenever Daniel and his friends were taken to Babylon in captivity around about 600 BC. They were only teenagers at that point, but now we jump on a little bit in history. And so in Daniel chapter 5, we're going to be introduced now to King Belshazzar. He's the last of the Babylonian kings. It's about 60 years later. Daniel's still a really key character in the kingdom. But the maths tell us he's now probably maybe 75 or 80 years old. And so he's had that life of experience, and the Lord has been with him throughout. Daniel chapter 5, reading page 889, this is the word of the Lord. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father or his predecessor, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, or I might say the queen mother, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "O king, live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man, Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to be put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. And this is the inscription that was written: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. This is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting, and Peresh, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Amen. We thank God for this reading.
Lovely. Well, let's take our Bibles together and turn to Daniel 5. The writings on the wall is what our biggest story entitles this. Indeed, it's what we would expect, perhaps, this chapter to be called, this well-known story. Now, if you've been here for a long time, you maybe have heard me use this illustration before, but transcript, apparently, of a conversation between an American Navy ship and some Canadian authorities off the coast of Newfoundland. It went something like this, apparently. Canadian said, "Please divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision." The American said, "Recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision." Canadian's negative, "You have to divert your course." And the American said, "This is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course." Canadian said, "No, no, you divert your course." And the Americans then sort of lost the run on themselves, and they said, "This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the U.S. Navy. We are accompanied by three destroyers, three cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. I say again, that's 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of the ship." And the Canadians came back and said, "Well, this is a lighthouse, and it's up to you." So human pride and stubbornness can be very strong, but even the most proud should realize that there are things that they must give way to. But sometimes it is the case that human pride fails to realize that it ought to and must give way to the Lord. Now, we saw last time that Nebuchadnezzar was a very proud man. He resisted the claims of God upon his life. But we know, too, that as the story goes on from chapter 3 into chapter 4, he is humbled and it seems he is converted. And in this chapter, we see another king, Belshazzar, who proudly resists God and is not converted. A man who ought to have humbled himself before the Lord and who does not and is lost. Now, lots of things have changed from chapter 3 and 4. There is a new king, Belshazzar. You'll notice in chapter 5, verse 2, that it does refer to Nebuchadnezzar as his father, but as Peter indicated, the word can mean ancestor or predecessor, and there are a couple of levels, it seems, between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar. And Belshazzar, it seems, is the co-regent. He's the son of his father, Nabonidus, something like that. Anyway, he ruled with him as sort of co-regent, and that's why in verse 16 he can offer Daniel the third highest in the kingdom, not the second highest in the kingdom. And yet he wants to identify with Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who has built Babylon to its height. I have an artist's illustration here of what Babylon looked like a little bit in those days. And it was just one of the most remarkable places, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the ancient wonders of the world, the huge river that ran through the center of the city. It was built up in the most remarkable way. A huge temple, of course, there. Nebuchadnezzar's palace was supposed to be one of the most magnificent buildings that has ever been constructed. And if you'll notice there on the left of the screen, there is that blue gate. That's the Ishtar Gate. That some of the tiles of that gate were excavated, and they were found in boxes, and they've been reconstructed in the Berlin Museum, the Pergamon Museum in Berlin on Museum Island. That exhibition has been closed for about 5 years. It's opened later this month. So if you're going to go to Berlin, just wait for another couple of weeks, and you really must see that. Some of the original tiles are in this recreation of part of the Ishtar Gate. It's about half the size of the original thing, and one of those most remarkable things that Daniel would have gone through all those years ago. It's beautiful just to read the scriptures and then dig around in the ground and find that the things that the Bible talks about are the things that were really there. Anyway, this is Belshazzar, and he lives in this tremendous city that he does not realize is hugely under threat at this point. And things have changed, not only in terms of politics, but the spiritual climate has changed. At the end of chapter 4, we find Nebuchadnezzar praising God and doing so in an official press release, which he circulates to the known world. But by chapter 5, all of this has been left behind. The king is not interested in praising God at all. He shows contempt for God by sending for the temple vessels for his party, as we'll see. And Daniel and his friends have been sidelined. And Daniel is, as we said, probably in his 80s at this stage. He's a very different point in his life. And there is no hint that any of his influence or principles have really carried across into this new reign. And you wonder what has happened. Has there been some concerted persecution? Well, it doesn't seem to be the case that has happened. It just seems to have happened quietly. These new leaders have let things slide. They've just quietly shelved Daniel and his friends. The momentum in leadership and in society is moving in a different direction, and Daniel is now seen as pretty irrelevant. We've seen something perhaps similar in our lifetime. Some of us, those who are older, have seen huge changes in our society. You've seen a pushing of God and the things of God to the periphery of life, and a quiet shelving of God's people. Now, there might be an indication that things are changing a little bit. I don't know if that's the case or not. We've heard of this quiet revival that particularly seems to be generating interest amongst younger men within the Western world and within the Western United Kingdom and British Isles, people engaging in Christianity. Interestingly, we heard this week that our online viewing figures come with some data. You know, whenever you accept a cookie, you are telling somebody something about yourself. And so we get some information about who views our YouTube channel in terms of their age profile and so on. And we've seen a significant increase in young men watching our services. May well be that Peter's just got a lot of friends, but it might not. It might be something else. And we do pray, don't we, that God will do something in our day and generation that will lead a new generation to come to know Him. But whatever is going on now, in those days, we find that Daniel was faithful and ready to serve whenever he was called upon. As if to say, whether the tide is with you or against you, this is what we need to be like. So you know, Daniel was persecuted at times. He was faithful. He was elevated at times. He was faithful. He was relegated at times. And he was faithful. We've quoted a little poem that I heard Alistair Begg use first. One ship sails east and another west by the selfsame winds that blow. 'Tis the set of the sails and not the gales that tells the way we go. And you see, Daniel, whatever the way the wind was blowing in Babylon, had set his course to be faithful to the Lord, and he wouldn't deviate from it. And I'm sure that part of the reason for that was that he had this deep sense that the Lord was in control. We're going to see that in this chapter. And Daniel knew that. He knew that he'd allowed God's people to go to Babylon. He knew that he had allowed Nebuchadnezzar to be in power. He knew that he had allowed Belshazzar to be in power. And that saved him from getting carried away when the wind was blowing with him, and from delving into despair whenever the wind was against him. So whether the climate is difficult or encouraging, Daniel's just always ready and faithful. And you've got to ask the question, is that what we're like? When the challenge comes, does it catch us unawares? Does it leave us saying, oh, you know, I haven't really been where I should be. I haven't really been reading my Bible. I haven't really been to church much. Or are we just ready to go? And Daniel was, even in his 80s. Well, the focus of this chapter is not so much Daniel, but it is much more Belshazzar, this man on whom judgment is pronounced so dramatically. And we're just going to see the descent of this king. He's a king who partied, he's a king who trembled, and he's a king who was lost. We'll see that in a moment or two when the computer decides to tell us. So first of all, he's a king who partied. Belshazzar threw a party, and what a party it was. A thousand of his nobles there. Archaeologists have done a lot of work on Babylon, and they have unearthed a throne room in ancient Babylon, which could well have been the very room that this took place in. It's 160 feet long and 60 feet wide. Interestingly, it has an alcove in the middle with a plaster wall on it. There are two things that stand out about this party. One, that it was a particularly drunken affair. It's five times in the first four verses it mentions that they were drinking. And the point is being made that with this free bar that Belshazzar was providing, it was a really boozy do. And the second thing that stands out about this party is it's a pretty immoral thing. Implied that by both the fact that Belshazzar's wives and his concubines, the harem, was there as verse 3 tells us, and apparently that wasn't really done. The harem was supposed to be kept separate from the wives and so on, and here they are all together, and so this is giving us the impression that all the rules have sort of been put to the side, and this is a pretty immoral sort of gathering. And you can just imagine how the people would have spoken about Belshazzar. You can imagine the nobles meeting at the bar. Hi, I haven't seen you for a long time. Where are you working at the moment? Oh, I'm in the civil service and I'm doing this and that. But what a great party this is, isn't it? One thing about Belshazzar, he really knows how to give us a good time. He knows how to have fun. Isn't Babylon a great place to live at the moment? Well, the wine got hold of Belshazzar, it seems, and he has an idea. And he sends for the gold goblets that have been captured from the temple in Jerusalem, and they're stored in the pagan temple in Babylon. It's their way of saying that our God triumphs over all. Your God was supposed to protect you, but he hasn't protected you because you're here, and all your stuff is here, all the good things that you had, we've got. And there was a huge amount of gold, of course, in the Jerusalem temple, and now it is in the temple in Babylon. And as the party hots up, they praise the gods of gold and silver. Nebuchadnezzar had at least treated these things with some respect, it seems, and Belshazzar uses them to impress his friends. Praising the gods of gold and silver, was it what they were singing about? Was it Belshazzar himself saying, write a toast to the gods of gold, the Babylonian gods that have given us all these things in silver. So he's a king who parties. He's the same king who sets out to enjoy himself and impress his friends and indulge in what he values. We let ourselves go for the things that we value, don't we? And then God intervenes, and he becomes a king who trembles. It's one of the most eerie events in the Bible, isn't it? Suddenly, verse 5, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. You can just imagine the music stops. Some people scream. Then there's a deathly silence. And the words are scratched into the plaster. The dust falls to the floor. And Belshazzar's face strains and his knees knock. And finally, his legs won't hold him up, and down he goes. And what does he do? Well, he does what people with influence can do whenever they have a problem. He throws money at it, and he brings in his top people, his astrologers, and he offers them rewards and promotions and so on, but no one can interpret what they see. And finally, the queen or the queen mother tells him about Daniel. There is a man. Wouldn't it be great if people were to say that about us? You're facing this terrible problem, but there is a man or there is a woman who knows the Lord, and I think they could help you. Well, Daniel is that man. He is sent for. He speaks to Belshazzar, and you'll see what he says to him in verses 18 to 21. He reminds him of Nebuchadnezzar. He reminds him of that proud, once proud king that God humbled. And then he says in verse 22, "But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven." It's really the key verse as far as Belshazzar is concerned. You knew all this. Belshazzar's probably in his 40s. He's lived through the days that God has done remarkable things in the land. He's lived through the days of the fiery furnace. He's probably born around that time or shortly afterwards. And you can imagine how a story like that would get around, influence a young person growing up. Surely the God who did that should be trusted and feared. He's lived through the time of Nebuchadnezzar's descent into madness and his recovery and his testimony that has gone out to all the known world that God has done this and he should be worshipped. And yet, though he knows these things, he has not done anything about it. He's run in the opposite direction. It was okay for him, old Nebuchadnezzar. He wasn't as strong as everybody thought. He needed the crutch of this God, not me. And even in his party, he runs in the opposite direction. And you can see Daniel points out how futile it is in verse 23. "You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze and iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways." And so the writing on the wall is for him. Specifically, it is four words of judgment. They are not special words. They are words from the marketplace, probably referring to weights and measures. And the meaning is all important for Belshazzar. Now, I don't know if you remember where you were on Sunday the 8th of December last year in the evening, but I might be able to tell you where you were, because if you were in church, you were here, and Stephen was speaking on Daniel at the time, and he looked at this chapter and was so incredibly helpful on this, and he helped us to see how those words, the Hebrew letters and so on, had sort of double ways of being read and how they all link together. And you really should look that up. It's on YouTube. It's Sunday the 8th of December. It's the Daniel sermon just before Christmas. Now, we're not going to go into all of that, because you can look that up. But what do these words mean? Well, meaning his days have been numbered. His reign is brought to an end. Psalm 90, written by Moses, tells us that our lives quickly pass away, and he says, "Teach us to number our days aright." And you see, the reason that we're to number our days is that God is numbering our days. He has set a limit on our lives. He has drawn a line in the sand over which we will not pass. And for Belshazzar, he had come upon that line, even though until this point he did not know that. Remember the rich farmer that Luke tells us about? He tore down his barns to build bigger ones, and then God says, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you." And God is saying to Belshazzar, tonight, you've reached the line. The days of your reign are over. The days of your life are over. Your days have been numbered. Tekel, you've been weighed and found wanting. And you see, this is the God. Not only does he number our days, but he weighs our days. He weighs our lives. It was weighed in the balance. Did his life flash before him as he heard those words? Did he think of all those things that he'd managed to just about forget? Did he realize with horror that God knew all about him? That everything he was an open book towards him. Remember the woman at the well who meets Jesus, and she rushes back to the village and she says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. You see, that's either the most comforting thing in the world. It was for her. She's delighted. But it can be the most threatening thing in the world. The man who knows me, the God who truly sees me, I've been weighed. Parson, his kingdom divided and passed on to the Medes and Persians. All he had worked for, all he had achieved, gone. All he had dreamed of developing, never realized. What a verdict on his life. I wonder what they put in his tombstone. Rest in peace? Hardly. Found wanting. King who trembled. And then finally, a king who's lost. It's the most solemn thing about him, really. Daniel does not appeal to him. Remember in chapter 4 when Daniel interprets the dreams for Nebuchadnezzar, he gives him some advice. He says, renounce your sins. He appeals to him. He offers him the gospel effectively. But there is none of that here. Daniel doesn't say, look, Belshazzar, this is really, really terrible, but if you'll take a few moments just now and acknowledge God, perhaps these terrible things will not happen to you. Perhaps it's a warning and not a sentence. But he doesn't say that. He just says, this is what God has said. Now, why do you think that is? It just seems that Belshazzar is someone who has become hardened by all that he has seen, and he's rejected the Lord. So he too, you see, has set his seal, and his course is away from the Lord, and he might think that he can turn himself around anytime he wants, but his course is sort of dialed in. I heard a speaker this week, as I listened to something on this, he talked about a conversation that he had with a man who said to him, you know, I fully intend to turn to the Lord in future, my later life. And this speaker was really quite clever, and he said to him, well, I'll tell you what, let's, just to make sure, let's have a dry run right now. Let's just imagine that you're going to turn to the Lord. What would you do? And the man said, well, I don't really know. And so he asked him, well, you know, what you've done is you've just said this to give yourself an excuse to hold on to. And if you don't know what to do now, what makes you think you'll know what to do then? Or whether you'll want to really then? You don't want to now. Will you want to then? And you see, this is Belshazzar. He's ignoring the Lord, and it's not a warning to him. It is a sentence. Because he knew the way. You, Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, even though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. It is a big thing to sin against the light, isn't it? To turn against what we know when we know the gospel. Remember, Jesus did the same thing with Herod. Herod had imprisoned John the Baptist, and we discover that he had quite a soft spot for John, and he liked to hear him preach. And he went down to listen to him from time to time. He wrestled with the things of God. And he'd then, some time later, and yet, of course, he then caused him to lose his head. And then sometime later, he finds that Jesus is there, and he brings him before him just before the crucifixion. And it says he asked Jesus many questions, but Jesus did not reply. He had his opportunity, you see. and the Savior that he desperately needed but didn't really want was right in front of him. You ever heard this little verse? There is a time, we know not when, a place, we know not where, that marks the destiny of man in glory or despair. There is a line by us unseen that crosses every path, the hidden boundary between God's patience and his wrath. You see, we have as human beings this remarkable capacity for optimism, don't we? When it comes to God, what is it we sometimes say? I'm sure it will work out okay for me in the end. I've heard people say that. And of course, from a particular perspective, we don't really know, do we? Because for Nebuchadnezzar, well, it sort of did. Well, it did. He put God off again and again. He ignored God's call to him many times. But it worked out okay for him because he did bow the knee to God in the end. He was converted. But that's not how it was for Belshazzar. He had his opportunities, and there were no more. And verse 30 says, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. Babylon, as we saw in the image, surrounded by a great wall, but the river flowed through it under the wall, and the Medes diverted the river upstream into a swamp. And so the level dropped, and it allowed the cities to the soldiers to get in under the wall and into the city. And we're told that they took the city with very little resistance, almost no resistance, that very night, the very night that God wrote these things on the wall in front of Belshazzar. The writing's on the wall. The end has come. You see, when we are faced, no matter how strong we are, like that American warship, no matter how strong we are, when we are faced with the immovable God, we must bow before him. And you see, those of us this morning who are believers, we know that that is the sweetest thing, isn't it? Isn't it the sweetest thing to bow before the Lord? Because suddenly we feel we've found our place. Our place is not plowing through life thinking that we're in charge. We come from that position of bowing before the Lord, and we look at those days and we think, what a fool I was. What heartache that brought me. But here, to bow here is so sweet. I'm home. What a joy it is to know that God is God and I am not. But what if we're not yet Christians? That we've not yet come to the Lord. Well, in the mercy of the Lord, you've come here. Maybe you didn't even intend to. And you've heard this story today. And it comes to you. Please God, it comes to you not as a sentence, but as a warning. That you must not set yourself up against the Lord, but must humble yourself before the Lord. And it is our prayer that you might be given and find grace to do that, knowing that there, as we bow before him, that's where we were meant to be all along. And that's what it really means to be the people that God has called us to be. To you now and forever. Amen.